Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Today we'll talk about how the rich used to lose and the poor used to win.
Over the first half of the 20th century, average Americans rose up and really pummeled our plutocracy. And the rich, which started the 20th century in the early 1900s as a totally dominant force in American life, by the middle of the 20th century had been cut down, had been shrunken down to something approximating democratic size. It was a tremendous triumph for average Americans, but a triumph that's been largely forgotten.
This progress was made possible by a different mentality about the aims of politics.
Early in the 20th century, all progressives from a little left of center, straight through the institutional left, from progressive Republicans to Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party, all folks who considered themselves fighters for a decent society, agreed on the basic strategic direction. And that is, they agreed that if we're going to have decency in the United States, we had to do two things. We had to level up the bottom, and we had to level down the top.
I'm thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Sam Pizzagatti. Sam is a labor journalist, an author, an associate fellow at IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, where he edits the online weekly Too Much, which can be found at toomuchonline.org. Sam Pizzagatti is the author of a terrific brand new book called The Rich Don't Always Win: The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, 1900 to 1970. Quite a big topic. Sam Pizzagatti, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
So this might actually strike some people, some recent observers of recent U.S. politics, as heresy to suggest that the rich don't always win. What can you mean by that?
Well, you know, we have a deep well of cynicism in our political culture, the idea that you can't fight City Hall, and the rich always win is part of that culture of cynicism, that culture of defeatism that's been drummed into to average Americans. But in fact, over the first half of the 20th century, average Americans rose up and really pummeled our plutocracy. And the rich, which started the 20th century in the early 1900s as a totally dominant force in American life, by the middle of the 20th century had been cut down, had been shrunken down to something approximating democratic size. It was a tremendous triumph for average Americans, but a triumph that's been largely forgotten.
Indeed, it seems to me that a lot of people run around comparing today's economic situation to that of a century or more ago. Here we are in the second Gilded Age. Here we are with inequality approaching or surpassing that of the 1920s. And we don't stop and think, well, what happened in between? How is it that we got out of the first Gilded Age, saw the equalization of wealth, relatively speaking, and then returned? What are the general themes of this story of how things actually went right?
Well, there are a couple of things that happened. Essentially, over the first half of the 20th century, average working people created two major institutions that had an awesome equalizing impact on the American economy, on American politics. The first was the rise of the steeply graduated progressive income tax. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was no income tax. Rich people paid none, not 1 cent of their incomes in federal income tax. By the middle of the 20th century, the tax rate on income over $400,000 was 91%, and the estate tax, the top estate tax on the inheritances was 77%. Again, and there was no estate tax at the beginning of the 20th century. So this progressive income tax made quite a difference. The second factor was the rise of the trade union movement. At the beginning of the 20th century, unions were incredibly weak all over the country. By the middle of the 20th century, almost half the private sector workforce outside the South, which was almost totally union, carried union cards. And even non-union employers in most of the country had to pay union wages because unions were so prevalent in the labor market. So those two factors, the rise of unions and the rise of the progressive income tax, had this tremendous equalizing impact. Unfortunately, over the past 30 years, both these institutional pillars of equality have toppled over and crumbled.
How do the figures compare? How does a 94% top marginal income tax rate compare to today, and a 71% estate tax rate compare to today? And how does unionization rates at the peak of the U.S. labor movement compare to where we are now?
So on unionization rates, in the early 1950s, for the total workforce, public and private, 35% of workers belonged to unions back in 1955. And again, that was distorted by the South. Outside the South, it was almost 50%. Today, in the private sector, only 7% of workers belong to unions. So there's been a tremendous, tremendous change there. On tax rights, during the 1950s, when Dwight Eisenhower was a president, the top tax rate was 91%. Today, the top tax rate is 35%. On estate tax, the estate tax rate has gone down now to 45% as the top. So we've had a tremendous change in both taxes taxes on the rich and on unionization rates.
Was 91 the top rate ever? I thought it was 94.
It was the 94 during World War II was the top rate. And actually, in 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt proposed a 100% tax rate on income over $25,000. Income over $25,000 equals about $350,000 in today's dollars. Franklin Roosevelt wanted that all taxed away, all income over that equivalent of $350,000. Congress didn't go along with that, but Congress did set the tax rate, the top tax rate, at 94% during World War II.
We seem to be putting into some stark perspective the debate happening in current days over this so-called apocalypse of a fiscal cliff that would result from moving top tax rates for the wealthy in this country from, what, 35 up to 36? What are we talking about here? We're not talking about 94.
Well, yes, that's right. If President Obama gets his way, the top tax rate will move up to 39.6%. And the irony here, David, is just incredible. Right now, Republicans cannot fathom, cannot tolerate the tax rate moving even a hair over 35%. Back in 1948, after World War II, the Republican majority in Congress celebrated when it was able to temporarily lower the top tax rate down to 82%. So compare those two eras today and 1948. 1948, the Republicans celebrate when they get the top tax rate down to 82%. Today, Republicans are dead set against letting the tax rate rise one penny over 35%.
We're speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, author of an incredible new book called The Rich Don't Always Win. It seems to me, Sam, that in the history you tell, simultaneous with the growth of the labor movement and with progressive taxation, and in fact for many years prior to those successes, people were doing the sort of thing you're doing with this book, and that is building an awareness and an understanding, educating others, and really creating a mentality that I don't think is widespread anymore. The idea that, in fact, the rich need to be made poorer for the good of the country.
That's exactly right, David. You put your finger on a very key message of the book, and that is that early in the 20th century, all progressives, from a little left of center, straight through the institutional left, from progressive Republicans to Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party, all folks who considered themselves fighters for a decent society, agreed on the basic strategic direction. And that is, they agreed that if we're going to have decency in the United States, we had to do two things. We had to level up the bottom, and we had to level down the top. And unless we did both things, unless we struggled as hard as we could to do both these things, we were not going to succeed. We were not going to create a decent society. And that notion that we had to level down, as you just noted, was prevalent throughout progressive ranks. But what happened after World War, after World War II, we had McCarthyism, we had the Red Scare, and essentially the liberal mainstream at that time stopped talking about leveling down the rich. In fact, they claimed, they charged, that people who were talking about leveling down the rich were distracting us from our real chore, which was leveling up the bottom. And that was a recipe for political disaster. That opened the door for attacks on the equality that we had created in the mid-20th century. Ronald Reagan's rhetoric came from John F. Kennedy. Kennedy said famously, a rising tide lifts all boats. That notion that we didn't have to worry about distribution, all we had to worry about was economic growth. If the pie grew larger, everybody would have more. We didn't have to worry how that pie was sliced. That's the rhetoric, that's the notion that Ronald Reagan and the Republican right picked up on and used to bludgeon equality, used to create the unequal society we have today.
And yet these stories that you tell through this book transpire over decades, and the disaster has been ongoing for decades now, and the victory was decades in the coming. And it seems to me there might be lessons to be learned from the long-term vision and activism that you describe people engaging in the early part of the 20th century and even the end of the 19th century, from the days of Henry George and Edward Bellamy and people who died before victory ever really came. Is there something to be learned from going back and looking at how this happened?
Yes, I clearly think there is. I think that we can take inspiration from the perseverance that our progressive forebears showed over the first half of the over the 20th century. We have garment workers who were involved in the great strikes of 1911 and 1912, who later popped up as old women marching picket lines in the early 1950s. Stories like this, to me, are just incredibly inspiring and drive home the message that we can create a more equal United States, we can create a better society, but it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen without a real commitment to lifelong struggle.
And it seems that a key part of that struggle has been civil disobedience, civil resistance, nonviolent activism, that it hasn't been accomplished purely through education or lobbying or voting. Is there something to be learned there as well?
Yes, and in fact, the rise of the labor movement, which is a major theme of the rich don't always win, that would have not happened without civil disobedience. That was workers in the 1930s who occupied their factories, who sat down in their factories, who disrupted production in unorthodox ways. It was these workers who set the stage for what was to follow in the 1950s and 1960s. And the success we achieved would not have been achieved without their efforts, and without efforts by people like them throughout the beginning of the 20th century.
You also tell the story of independent activism, of radical organizing, and in more than one incident through the course of the decades of third-party political campaigns, including presidential campaigns, moving the agenda of the other parties and the incumbent president, which seems... one tactic that has sort of been taken completely off the board, where we think of third party candidacies as potentially spoiling everything, we don't think of them any longer as potentially moving the other two parties in the right direction. What's changed there?
Well, that's right, and in fact, one of the greatest presidential elections ever was actually a four-party election, and that was in 1912, where we had Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive Republican, splitting off from the Republican Party. At the same time, we had Eugene Victor Debs, the head of the Socialist Party, running his most important race ever. And people today would say, oh, how horrible that must have been. The progressive vote must have been split, and it must have opened the door for the right to sneak in. But actually, the opposite happened. In 1912, the candidate of the plutocratic status quo, the incumbent Republican, William Howard Taft, only received 23% of the vote. In other words, 75% of Americans voted against plutocracy. And it was the energy that came from Debs, it was the energy that came from Teddy Roosevelt's progressive challenge that pushed Woodrow Wilson to the left and created the gains of the mid-19 years.
Which then struggled with the war that Woodrow Wilson took us into.
That's right, and that war broke the back of the progressive movement. Before the war, the progressive movement had been united in pushing for domestic social change. The war and the Red Scare that followed immediately after war broke that unity and set the stage for a mini plutocratic restoration that then we had to struggle against during the Great Depression years.
And that seems to be the norm in many countries for centuries now. When a war happens, that progressive causes are abandoned or set back. But the story of World War II, as you tell it, is rather mixed in that there was also massive spending of the sort we seem unable to get our government to engage in for anything other than killing people.
Yes, World War II brought a massive expenditure of federal dollars to fight and wage the war, and that had an incredible stimulating impact on the economy. But World War II also brought all sorts of gains in other areas. Unions were recognized as never before. Unions bargained for pensions and health care benefits that had never been bargained for before. There were important gains against racial bigotry during World War II as well. And at the end of the war, we had a different situation at the end of World War One. At the end of World War One, the progressives were split, and that opened the door to plutocratic restoration. At the end of World War Two, the plutocrats were split because that war had been so horrific, and that war had followed on the heels of a horrific global economic depression, and those twin horrific events sort of drove a healthy share of America's rich and comfortable to rethink where they were at. And they essentially said, we cannot risk a repeat of this. The next war could be the end of the world. We needed a more equal United States to be able to avoid the economic cataclysm that led to the global military cataclysm of World War II. And so that set the stage for the great middle class bursting onto the scene that we saw in the 1950s and 60s.
Your book, The Rich Don't Always Win, ends, and its title ends, with the date 1970, of course, during another war, the Vietnam War, which again split the left. Do you see a comparison there to 1918, or what is it about 1970 that ends the progress for equality?
Well, that's a good question, and any date in a situation like this is somewhat arbitrary. But we know from the income and wealth statistics that we have that the peak of income and wealth equality in the United States came in the late 1960s, early 1970s. After that, the economy became progressively more unequal. After 1980, that process of inequality turbocharged. But on your point on the Vietnam War, that had a very interesting psychological impact. Because the left, the new left, a left that I was part of back in the 1960s, when we looked at the country, we saw a country engaged in a horrible war in Southeast Asia, and we were not about to celebrate the accomplishments of that country that was involved in this horrible war in Southeast Asia. And I think psychologically, the new left was ill-prepared to defend the gains that our progressive forebears had won. So when equality came under attack in the United States, the new left was not there to defend it. And that's one of the legacies of the Vietnam War that I think has been forgotten. If it weren't for the war, perhaps progressives in the 1960s would have stood up and defended the gains that had led to the equality of the mid-20th century.
Can we do so now? And in doing so, should and can we rebuild the labor movement?
Yes, we cannot achieve a more equal nation without the rebuilding of the labor movement. I think that's a progressive job, one. And I think it's heartening that we see stirrings around the country now in the new Walmart struggles and the new fast food restaurant struggles that we see. We see signs of labor union revival, and those are incredibly heartening to me.
What should our goals be? What should our policy desires be? I know you've promoted for quite some time the idea of a maximum income. Do you think that's an important policy goal? And if so, how would you explain it to people?
Yes, I think the idea that we need to cap income is fundamentally important to the struggle for a more United States. And I think people understand that idea. I think people understand the notion that a civilized society sets limits. We set limits on motorists, for instance. We say you can only go so fast on our roads, and if you go faster, that's going to endanger our community, our public health. We say to hunters, you can only shoot so many ducks. If you shoot an unlimited number of ducks, our wildlife are going to suffer. But by the same token, we need limits on income accumulation. We cannot allow wealth to continue to concentrate in the pockets of a few people. It's not good for our community health. It's not good for our democracy. And I think more and more Americans are coming to that sort of understanding.
And yet we have 400 or so Americans with billions of dollars, some of them $50-60 billion, piled up and hoarded away, while others starve and go without housing and go without medicine. And were they not to receive another dime of income, they would have that money, and they would pass it on to their heirs. Do we not need a wealth tax? Do we not need an estate tax?
Yes, I think we do. I think what we ought to be debating now is what are the best ways to limit the accumulations of grand hoards of private wealth. A maximum wage is one way of doing that. A stiffer estate tax, a regular annual wealth tax. There are all sorts of ways that we can go about that. And I think those of us on the progressive side of the political spectrum ought to be debating these, or to be pursuing this goal from all sorts of different directions. But first, it goes back to creating that sense that we need to put some limits on the accumulation of a private fortune. That's a consensus that existed at the beginning of the 20th century among progressives. It's not a consensus that exists right now among progressives.
How should we have just a few minutes left? How should we be thinking about the rich? Can Americans in today's political climate and cultural understanding think about depriving the rich of their hoarded wealth as something that isn't cruel and vengeful, but necessary and intended for the good of all, the rich themselves included? Or should they in fact think of it as necessary, malicious, vengeful energy directed at the enemies of their country? How should we be approaching this?
Well, I think we should be approaching this in one sense from the vantage point of the world's epidemiologists. Epidemiologists are scientists who study the health of populations. And over the past 30 years, we've seen an explosion of epidemiological research that compares the nations of the world as well as the states within the United States. And what this research shows is that the more unequal a society, that is, the more that wealth concentrates at the top, the unhealthier that society is for everybody. In other words, if you live in a deeply unequal nation, a nation where wealth is concentrated at the top, you're going to live a shorter life. We're talking here not just about poor people in those societies, we're talking about middle-class people and affluent people. All people in distinctly unequal societies live less healthy, less long lives than people in more equal societies. So it's in the well-being, it's in the self-interest of all of us, poor, middle, and affluent, to live in countries that have a more reasonable distribution of income and wealth.
We have been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who is the author of a number of terrific books, including the latest, which we've been speaking about, The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, 1900 to 1970. We should go back and learn what was done, how it worked, and do it again, but do it faster than it took them last time. Sam, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.